Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, my name is Michael Green. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Melbourne. I respectfully acknowledge that today I'm speaking from the lands of the Kulin Nation, in particular the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people. I pay respects to their elders and to the elders of all communities and cultures across Australia. So I have done a lot of reporting on Australia's offshore immigration detention system in the last decade. But in this podcast, I'm going to be speaking with Abbas Nazari. He's the author of After the Tampa, From Afghanistan to New Zealand. It's a book that really covers the beginning of that architecture of the offshore detention system and all that has followed since then. It's a really thoughtful, compelling, and moving account of Abbas's family's experience leaving their village in Afghanistan in 2001, crossing to Pakistan, then Indonesia, and finding themselves getting on a fishing boat, the Palapa, aiming for Christmas Island. Abbas writes about the experience of being rescued and then stranded on the Tampa, and then his family's lives since then in New Zealand. Abbas is in Wellington today in New Zealand. I can see him on my screen wearing a delightful purple jumper. He recently returned to New Zealand after a stint living, studying and writing his book while in Washington, D.C. He was studying at Georgetown University. He was there as a Fulbright scholar.
G'day, Michael, and thanks for having me.
Oh, look, it's a real pleasure. As you might have heard from my little intro, I really, really enjoyed reading your book. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. And to be honest, the reception to that book in the last month since its publication, you know, in the middle of August has been incredible. Writing a book that is even vaguely about Afghanistan from an Afghan perspective at this time, given events on the ground, it's been, a bittersweet moment because you couldn't time an Afghan story better. I wish it was under better circumstances.
Yeah, it is. We're going to get to that a little bit later, but it is an extraordinary sort of moment for your book to come out. How did it come out? Because it's one thing for you to have lived that experience as a small boy on the Tampa and what's happened since then for your family, but how did you come about writing a book?
You know, that's a really, really cool question that often gets overlooked. Look, in the middle of 2019, in about June of 2019, I was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to the United States. It's a pretty prestigious scholarship. And when they made the press release about that year's recipients, I got a bit of media attention because
I read the articles at that time, yeah?
That's right. So I got a bit of media attention about it because, you know, it's a really feel-good story. And a lot of people in New Zealand especially are still interested in what the Tampa refugee kids are up to. And so off the back of that, the lovely Jenny Helen, who's with Allen and Unwin here in New Zealand, she got in touch and she proposed the idea of writing this book. And since then, it was about a two-year journey to it finally hitting the shelves in August of 2021.
Okay, so were you spending 2 years writing the book, or?
That's right. So there was a bit of back and forth between me and the publisher, simply because at first I was a bit apprehensive for two reasons. One, I was about to embark on full time study again at Georgetown in a foreign city, foreign country, full time student again. And two, you know, I genuinely asked myself whether this would be a story that many folks would be interested in. I asked myself a lot about, what is the point of this story? Who would be interested in it? What am I trying to say? And I acknowledge all of those questions in the prologue section of the book. But after a bit of to-ing and fro-ing, I realized that there is immense interest, that here was an opportunity to write down our experiences of having been rescued by the Tampa, and most importantly, what we've been up to in the last 20 years since. So once I got to it, the writing process itself was about 12 to 18 months, mm-hmm. and right in the middle of a global pandemic. So that actually was a silver lining. I always joke that a lot of people during the pandemic learned how to bake sourdough. I wrote a book, so that is my sourdough. And it took a lot longer to bake and get right than most others.
To ferment, right?
That's right. That's right.
And obviously you thought really carefully then about the way you'd approach it. I was struck by the quote that you put before the prologue. I'll just read it out. It's a Rumi quote that out beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field, and I'll meet you there. Tell me about that quote and why you chose to open your book with that.
You know, that quote means a hell of a lot to me in so many ways. I mean, it sums up our experience of bridging two very different worlds, of coming from a country as destitute and desperate and poor as Afghanistan to being given a whole new lease on life here in New Zealand, of those two worlds colliding in the most magnificent way. But most importantly, I try to do this through the words in my book about really trying to bridge differences. And what I mean by that is a lot of folks, when they think or when they hear about refugees, they have their inbuilt biases, either for or against, and they have either a very strong positive or a very strong, almost allergic reaction to refugees. And I think nowhere is that more relevant than in Australia. So something I tried to carry out through the words in that book actually are, look, let's set aside differences and just really cut through some of the issues regarding the refugee and migrant crises. Sure, I'm biased. I've obviously haven't gone through the process myself. But the way I've written the book is to try and appeal to the vast or the largest number of people. And I think I've done that, and I can see that in the reviews and the comments that I've received since it's been out there.
Yeah, you do get a sense of a really sort of balanced and moderate narrator, and you speak, often of kinds of values that could be held across the political spectrum, like the virtues of hard work and the pride that your family felt, when you were able to stand on your own two feet, those scenes of picking berries, how deliberate was that sort of approach? Was it something that you developed, gradually through the course of the writing, or was it something that just sort of emerged as something true to your person?
That right there is something that I wrestled with quite a bit, because I, just to step back from that a little bit. One thing I always know, I've always experienced on social media, in the real world, in traditional media, in day-to-day interactions, is that sadly a lot of folks speak and talk to and interact with folks who are by and large the same as themselves, the same social circles, the same political beliefs, the same socioeconomic status, all the rest of it. And so I could have easily gone down that road and written a book for folks who are really pro-refugee, who are in the know, who know exactly what to do and who to speak with, and they're very engaged in the topic. But the more I thought about it, the more I said, no, I actually want to speak to the vast majority of people on all sides of the political spectrum, regardless of your left, right, or your support, whichever party or whichever prime minister. And so when I did that, I really wanted to make sure that aspects that would tick the boxes with so many different viewpoints were in the book. But more importantly, something I always say is that it's my face and my name on the cover. But what I really wanted to do was tell the story of the other 400-odd asylum seekers who were rescued by the Tampa. Mm-hmm. And in that 400-odd people, you're going to have a vast majority of opinion, people who vote differently, people who believe differently, people who think that you should highlight this aspect more than the others. And so if it was just me speaking for myself, it might look a little different, but I really wanted to get those other opinions and voices across as well. And finally, when I read the final thing, I think I did a pretty good job of that.
Is there something, it is a little bit of a common sort of sense that I've had from speaking with refugees, former refugees in Australia, potentially, that there are some things they can say and some things that they can't say about their experience for fear of, alienating people. you know, you touched on that a little bit, but are there things that you felt like you held back, you know, in order not to kind of upset or appear ungrateful?
Man, that right there hits the nail on the head, because one thing you learn when you write a book is that the first version is very, very different to the last version that finally goes to print. Mm-hmm. So when I compared the print version, the one that people have in their hands, to the first version that I had written, there was a huge difference. The first version was incredibly preachy, and me standing on a pedestal and shaking my finger at everyone and telling them what's right and what's wrong. And it was really almost like I had a sledgehammer in hand and I wanted to destroy everything. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that is no way to try and bring about folks who might have a different opinion to you. You know, you're never going to win an argument against someone by calling them a racist or a fascist or any other pejorative. You have to try and speak to them in a way so that your points of get across, but you're never disrespecting them because, you know, the way they view the world isn't through one dimension, right? It's a number of different layers and filters. So to answer your question, yeah, there was a lot more that I had written in there. But if I were to compare draft one versus the final version, I'm very, very happy with the final one. In terms of actual things that didn't make the cut, I had a far more a lengthier, I guess, diatribe with regards to Australian politics that had been written in the book that I eventually myself edited out. You know, things that I wanted to talk about regarding, you know, Australia's history of how do you want to describe it, of marginalisation, you know, of the Australian identity and what it means for different people. But I kind of took that out for two reasons. One, personally, I know a lot of Australians, a lot of Afghan Australians, but a lot of Australians from all different backgrounds. And I felt very hypocritical to lecture Australians on how they are and how they should be from little old New Zealand. So I took that out of my own accord. And those conversations are actually better had in platforms like this. And sadly, I would have loved to have them in person at the Melbourne Writers Festival as well. But yeah, no, they're still there in the back of my mind.
Maybe that's for the next book.
Right, that's right.
I mean, so the other thing that I was really curious about is, so, I mean, you were a good student. There's a and you've always had a love for words. There's a wonderful passage, and it's obviously part of all of the stories that are written about you, which is that you came third in the New Zealand Spelling Bee as a young man, that's just right, a few years after starting to learn English. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, turning a love for words into crafting a book word by word, sentence by sentence is a whole other thing. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your craft as a writer. What was it like learning to develop these passages into a book?
Yeah. You know, when I first started writing this book, before I even put a word on paper, I thought about what kind of books do I like and why do I like them? And by and large, the kind of books, especially autobiographies that I like, are ones where it almost feels like you and the author are sitting down around a fire with a beer in hand and you're just chatting away. And I thought the reason I like that is because I want to have that feeling of me sitting next to some great CEO or some great athlete or some great celebrity or whatever, and just sitting there talking through the issues about, you know, what'd you get up to? What were you feeling in the moment? All the rest of it. And so that is the style I adopted. I wanted the reader to pick up this book and sit down on their couch or their lounge or their backyard and just feel as if I'm sitting there right next to them just having a chat. So it's written in that aspect, in that style, and I really, really enjoyed both writing it, but the number one feedback I've received from readers is that they really appreciate the simplistic style of it. The actual process itself, it took about 12 months to go from zero words to 80,000 words. The silver lining to the pandemic was that I was in my apartment in Washington, D.C. when we went into lockdown, and that seemed endless. So March of 2020, I started writing, and for the first 3 or 4 months, we were stuck for 23 hours a day in our apartment. And that's when I really did the bulk of the work, first drawing on my own memories, then backfilling it by chatting to mostly my parents and then other Tampa survivors. and then putting literally chapter by chapter together, then going back and just taking a red pen to it and just slashing it to bits, and finally getting a first draft 12 months later. The part that I loved about it the most was actually talking to mum and dad. I was in DC, they were in our hometown of Christchurch, you know, over late night WhatsApp calls and Zoom calls, and asking them, and how even though we were distant and, you know, many thousands of miles apart, I felt like I was super close with my parents throughout their whole writing process. Mm-hmm. You know, chatting to them daily, almost 2 or 3 hours a day, making sure I got their voice across, making sure that I got their feelings, because they are, you know, the superheroes of this story are my mum and dad, and that's why they're in the dedication page. And that part of the process I really enjoyed. And I think it's one of the great benefits of having done it while I was overseas, because if I did do it with mum and dad being the same household, it probably won't feel as special. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a important time, I think, for lots of people to connect with the family, but from that distance and to bring up all those memories. I know at the start of the book, and you were a young boy, you were 7, and your depiction of the village that you grew up in Afghanistan was a very warm and quite moving one. And I wonder if you could, you know, take us back there.
Yeah, when I was writing that particular passage about growing up in Sangjoy, a little village there in Ghazni province, it was almost like a out-of-body experience, because I was walking down memory lane, but every sentence that I wrote about, you know, describing the summers and the winters and our walks to and from school and the houses and the people and the faces and places which make up that place for me so special. It was such a cool experience because, you know, most folks, when they think about Afghanistan, they have very vivid images of what their country looks like and feels like and should be like, mainly based on the imagery that we see on TV. But what I wanted to do in that description actually showed the other side of Afghanistan. You show what it's like a day in the life in a village up there in the mountains. And so many folks who've read the book said, I had no idea that there were soaring mountain peaks in Afghanistan, that you would be buried under half of, you know, waist high snow and all the rest of it. And I thought, yeah, that was my childhood growing up. So it was a very cool way to both think about the past, but also educate the folks in the present about what it's like in Afghanistan. It's still as beautiful as ever. I've been fortunate enough to go back to Afghanistan twice, one in 2012, one in 2017. And I write about the changes that have taken place since we left all the way back in 2001. You know, simple things like electricity and phone connections and solar power and the change in curriculum and the fact that most people have cars. It's a really cool way to sort of show the development journey that Afghanistan has been on in the last 20 years.
We'll come back a little bit later in a chat to what's happening in Afghanistan now, of course. But so obviously there was, you know, after you left the village, there was one heck of a journey for your family. I'm not going to ask you about it here because I think that it's important for our listeners to buy your book and read what you've written, how you've detailed that. But I wonder if you could fast forward a little bit to, you know, the episode on the Tampa. Again, you were a young boy, and in that passage, you know, you describe such a big sort of geopolitical story. I was wondering how you approached the writing of that and matching up, you know, even sort of rediscovering your memories of what happened, and then kind of matching it against, you know, the context, what other people found, and the politics of it to come to a version that is now printed on those pages. Can you maybe talk about that, how you found that as a writer?
Yes. That right there is so intrinsic in the entire writing process for me, because when you think about the Tampa, the average Australian, the average New Zealander, when they think about the Tampa, they're looking at it from the outside, even though it is so central to Australian politics and society at the time. The way I imagine it is that the average Australian or New Zealander is sitting on Christmas Island looking at the Tampa, which is about 3 miles out in the ocean. And the entire saga was happening out there on the deck of the boat while everyone else was on the island looking out. And then for me as a little kid, I was on the Tampa looking out towards the island. And those two never meet. Those eye lines of sight never meet. And now here through this book is a chance for those two people to finally connect. The person standing on the island and the boy standing on the deck of the Tampa to finally meet and say, this was my experience. What was yours? The average Australian can recall how the 2001 election was one of the most divisive and the reasons for it. And then me now on the other side can finally tell, well, this was my experience. While everything was being said about us, was being talked about us, was being formulated against us, this was my feeling and my experiences of having been on the boat. One of the more powerful sentences and passages that I wrote about in the book was that the way everything occurred, we might as well have been on another planet because we were disconnected from the outside world. Everything that was being written and talked about us was without our consent, without our involvement. And so we might as well have been a bunch of faceless and nameless foreigners. And that's exactly what ended up being. And now 20 years on from that, here is a chance for us to finally say, look, this is our story. This is what happened. This is how we felt. This is what we experienced. And those two pieces of the puzzle can finally connect. When I was talking to Alan and Unwin about why I should write this story, that was one of the reasons, one of the answers that came out super strong, to finally connect those two pieces.
And I wonder whether there was some connection for you as well, because, you know, there was your experience and then, you know, you went away, you got on with your life. You've been very, very, very busy. And then to sort of face up to that, the memories of what happened, but then also sort of tie in the larger context is, I imagine, a challenge. And I'm interested in the sort of new understandings or new meanings that you sort of were able to develop through that writing process for this event that obviously has loomed large over your life. But perhaps you were forced to investigate it in a different way.
Yeah. Look, I remember first actually seeing the pictures of the attacks of 9/11 when we were actually in Auckland in Mangere. And then on the back of that, we would see some of the images that had been on the ABC and all the other news channels in Australia about the Tampa. So we got to see the bird's eye helicopter view of the Tampa, and we were the folks on the ground, on the deck of the ship. And so when I wrote this book, I was doing, I was backfilling, I was doing the research for what was, you know, the newspaper articles, the reports to Parliament, all the rest of it that was written about us at the time. So here I am writing it in first person and then having to do a quick 180 and look at it, flip the script and look at it from a journalist perspective, a policy professional's perspective in Canberra, look at it from the Prime Minister's office, look at it from the average Australian voter's perspective. So it was, it adds a level of granularity and layers to the storytelling, which I really, really love, because, you know, your average reader probably remembers the images on TV, but they don't know what happened on the deck of the Tampa. Your average policy professional in Canberra knows clearly what was happening and what the conversation taking place in Canberra, but they had no idea what was happening in Wellington or on the ship. And so now finally you get those multiple perspectives all converging, and it adds some flavor to the story, which I really, really enjoy. And writing it, that required a lot of research. And going back to one of your earlier questions, it required me to write in a way so that you kind of hopefully leave some of your own biases aside and say, well, look, these are the facts. This is what happened, and make your own conclusions from that.
And if we leave the reader's conclusions aside for a moment and go back to yours, you know, looking at the Tampa, going through this process and now reflecting on it 20 years down the track, how do you see that event? You know, what sense can we make of it, given what's happened in Australian politics and world politics since then?
You know, in the book, the final chapter, when we were rescued and we're finally told that we're going to New Zealand, when we're about to board the little charter plane that would take us to New Zealand and give us a new life, I talk about, you know, reflecting on the apparatus that would be built following the Tampa, you know, the policy of offshore detention, the incredibly hardline stance on folks, on asylum seekers, folks seeking asylum and all the rest of it, and the sort of the demonization of refugees generally. I think it's pretty clear that the events leading up to 2001 and the Tampa affair had kind of been in the background in Australian politics, probably from the mid-80s. But the Tampa was a real turning point in Australian politics, I think, particularly regarding immigration and really regarding asylum seekers. And sadly, that apparatus is still in place today, supported by both of the major parties. So I think, look, in time, I'm pretty confident that, you know, when the last asylum seeker is finally sent home or sent overseas or resettled elsewhere, and the camps at Manus and Nauru are closed, and the entire chapter is, I guess you can turn the page on this, there'll be a bit of soul searching in Australia about why it is that we did what we did. You know, billions of taxpayer dollars, you know, thousands who were held offshore for years, some of whom were killed and some of whom others committed suicide, and many who are mentally scarred forever. So that will be the legacy. And I just hope that it doesn't get repeated. I pull no punches in the book about my thoughts on the people responsible for this. And I don't think anyone will be, should a commission of inquiry be conducted into this policy. You know, sadly, I don't think anyone will be held responsible. There'll be some recommendations made and people will just forget about it.
It makes me think as well of the other sort of, you know, there's lots of things that have happened in this particular time, this 20-year anniversary. Your book, you know, is, as we talked about earlier, you know, there is this extraordinary timing of it because of the extraordinary events that clustered together around that time. You know, one thing that, you know, it's just a coincidence, but, you know, you landed finally in New Zealand on the same day as the US troops landed in Afghanistan, and that sent off a whole other, you know, trajectory. Oh, and 9/11 happened in between. Mm-hmm.
You know, the set of, I don't even know what you want to call it, the serendipity of so many moments that just happen in time. You know, I landed in New Zealand September 28th, 2001, at the very, almost to the hour, at the very first CIA troops, CIA agents landed in Afghanistan on the war on terror. And then obviously 9/11 happened while we were on the HMAS Manora. And then fast forward 20 years where we are, you know, we had intended last month in August to host a Tampa 20 celebration in my hometown of Christchurch where the Prime Minister and many other dignitaries were to come. And the very week that we were supposed to have that was also when Kabul fell to the Taliban 20 years after we had we'd been rescued by the Tampa. Look, I don't know what to make of it. It just feels like we've come back full circle. And I juxtapose my life and the lives of the Tampa families in New Zealand against those who have been left in Afghanistan. And I think about how much progress, how much fulfilling our life has been, and how stuck and desperate and sad and tragic those Afghans who are stuck in Afghanistan, how different their course of life has been.
Yeah, there's a large part of the book where, you talked about you having gone back to Afghanistan a couple of times, particularly the most recent time, 2017, and your reflections on what had happened in the intervening period, and also your sort of hopes for what that country could become. So if we just perhaps for a moment set aside what's happened in that last 6 months. Maybe if you could talk to your sense of Afghanistan as a place and what you hope for it as you were writing the book.
You know, in my last trip to Afghanistan in 2017, we were in the back of a minivan going, I think we were traveling back into Kabul from somewhere. And on the outskirts of Kabul, I find myself daydreaming about the Afghanistan that could be, the Afghanistan in another world, where, you know, if you set your religious, tribal and ethnic differences aside, the country that could be possible. You know, I talked about the vast mineral wealth in Afghanistan, you know, very similar to Australia. I talk about the incredible resilience and dedication and commitment of Afghans, regardless of their ethnic background, particularly my own, the Hazara minority. And I talk about what could be achieved, and I give some examples about particularly women, young women especially, who have gone against the odds, who have gone against the fear and the doctrine that has hindered them for so long and what they've gone on to achieve. You know, I talk about in 2020, the young girl who topped the Afghan National University exams, you know, a coal miner's daughter who herself could have been killed when one of her school, you know, when her school was attacked by the Taliban, but yet she goes on to university. I talk about the Afghan girls' national robotics team. I talk about the young mayor, the young female mayor who at 26, you know, faced assassination attempts. All of those people who want to contribute to a more harmonious society. And yet, sadly, in the last, you know, couple of months with the Taliban takeover, all of that hangs in the balance.
Yeah, there was the sort of perhaps that your concluding passage about the situation in Afghanistan was you're reflecting on the ISK attacks from November 2020 at Kabul University. And you wrote, "Sadly, one thing is certain. By the time this book reaches your hands, there will have been countless more attacks, claiming the lives of even more innocent Afghans." And perhaps what has come to pass is even more horrifying than you envisaged at that time. I wonder if you could talk a little about what it's been like for you, your family, your community, watching it unfold.
You know, the book went to print, I think, in May of this year. And even then, the Taliban was starting to really make gains in their offensive, that which eventually resulted in the fall of Kabul on August 15th of this year. Were it not for the past 3 months, you know, Afghanistan would have hobbled along and it would have kept going, and it would have been incredibly slow, but, you know, pretty measurable progress. There's rampant corruption and all the rest of it, but by and large, people were pretty confident and happy and secure in their lives, for the most part. I'm not saying that that's the reality, but for the most part. But sadly, for the last 3 months, you know, things have taken a huge turn. We've come back full circle with the Taliban now taking over Kabul and essentially, you know, the dominant power in Afghanistan. A lot of people have, over the last month and a half, tried to forecast and predict what it's going to be like under Taliban rule. But trying to predict the future of Afghanistan, I think, is an impossible ask. It's an impossible task for anybody, regardless of their expertise. That country has surprised so many people. So my only hope is, you know, I'm an optimist at heart. My only hope is that the Taliban realize that they cannot rule in the same fashion which they did in the 1990s, that essentially made Afghanistan a pariah state, and sadly just hurt and broke the, you know, local Afghans. But if they are to learn that, I hope that they can rule with a moderate and a modernized form of governance. Sadly, the early indications are that that's unlikely to happen, given, you know, the, you know, recent news out of Afghanistan. You just look at the makeup and the lineup of their government, and it doesn't look all inclusive, does it? So I have no idea what will happen to Afghanistan. My thoughts and my energy is being is now focused on helping Afghans both here in New Zealand and Australia, but also lobbying our successive governments on how to assist Afghanistan, the Afghan-Australian and the Afghan-New Zealand community. And that's where we are today. Obviously, this is being recorded in late September. But we still have not heard anything from the Australian or the New Zealand government about how they will help the Afghan-Australian and the Afghan-New Zealand community.
And what would you like to see?
And that's it, right? The demands are very make demands like we're, you know, we're only asking and not giving back. But the things that are being asked for are very, very basic. Firstly, in Australia, there is something called the temporary protection visas. These are visas that essentially are bridging visas where you're no longer a citizen and you could be deported at any minute now. It's a very Australian thing to be able to say, you know, here, welcome to Australia, but, you know, you're almost a second-class citizen now where you can't, where you don't have the rights and you could be deported at the top, at the drop of a hat. And we're essentially asking for the 5,000 Afghans who are on TPVs to be given permanent residency, to give them some sense of security about their future in Australia, that they won't be, you know, deported back to Afghanistan. You know, so the number one is to get rid of the TPVs. Number two is an emergency intake of Afghan refugees, similar to Syria in 2015, which also New Zealand government helped as well. That number is fluid, but I think, you know, an immediate request of 15,000 to 20,000 would be more than doable. And keep in mind that the communities in Australia are more than willing to foot the bill for it, to offer housing and accommodation and employment opportunities. And I know there are towns across Australia, particularly rural towns, who are begging for more refugees in their community, particularly given their labour shortfall. And that's the same here in New Zealand as well. And number three, to continue to work and look at Afghanistan to put pressure on the Taliban government to try and get some concessions out, to say that if you want to be recognized, if you want access to your foreign reserves, if you want access to overseas development assistance, then you have to commit to a basic standard of norms and international relations. You know, let the girls go to school, protect doctors, protect female workers and all the rest of it. And so those three demands are easy and they're very actionable, but the silence from both, you know, the Morrison government and the Ardern government here in New Zealand is it's been pretty deafening and it's been very, very sad. I know that COVID and lockdown has dominated the news coverage, but there are far bigger problems facing Afghanistan than that.
As I was reading, I was sort of, I don't know too much about your studies and you don't go into it so much in the book, but I was wondering whether, I know that it was a Master's of Security Studies at Georgetown, and I was curious about whether your studies, influenced what your take on the book or your take on that kind of global politics that you go into.
Yeah, at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, I undertook a Master's in Security Studies with a particular focus on what they call terrorism and sub-state violence. This is essentially just warfare between groups below the state level. That particular academic pathway is incredibly pertinent today for a number of reasons. The reason I took that up was because of March 15th in my hometown of Christchurch. March 15th, some people may recall, was in 2019 when a 28-year-old Australian from Grafton, New South Wales, sadly, entered a mosque here in Christchurch and ended up killing 51 worshippers. And it revealed so many things about the rise of white supremacist ethno-nationalism, about the rise of and the lack of, the intelligence failures which allowed that to happen on a government level. And also what can be done, given that every country is now going to become more and more diverse and more interconnected, what can be done to prevent future attacks? So that's why I took it up at Georgetown. And you also look at what policies and institutional apparatuses can be put in place to prevent something like that or from any other militia taking over. Applying the academic lens to Afghanistan, man, it's like the textbook has come to life on that. Look, I mean, the Taliban, for example, I'll give you an example. The Taliban are now the government of Afghanistan, whether you like it or not. And now they have to deal with their own terrorism insurgency, because the likes of Islamic State, ISK, the Afghan chapter of IS, they are now conducting their own insurgency. And if you're the Taliban government, you now have to quell an insurgency of another terrorist group that has taken over your country. So it's fascinating to see. In the eyes of local Afghans, if the Taliban wishes to be the number one If the Taliban wishes to win legitimacy and be the number one government, then they have to actually, provide security for the Afghans the way our government and your government will have to provide security for us. So it's a fascinating way to look at Afghanistan and any other country, actually.
It's just an incredibly timely book in many ways, and I think that you have a lot to listeners, readers will get a lot out of your book because it does feel like now is the time to read it. I also am conscious that there's another part of the book that we haven't kind of managed to touch on, and we're going to have to wrap up now and we won't be able to, but there is this other side, which is about the way you and your family, you know, built a life in New Zealand. You played rugby, you even learnt to shoplift. and so I just thought...
favorite passages.
Yeah, I just thought I wanted to throw that out there for a listener, even though sadly I don't get to interrogate you on your criminal past. But readers of the book will have that all to look forward to.
Yeah, you know, in my mind, the 30-second version of my book is this. It's written in three parts, where the first part is our life and memories of growing up in Afghanistan. The second part is the journey from leaving our village to setting foot in New Zealand. And the third part, which is absolutely my favorite, is what have we been up to in the last 20 years? You know, whatever happened to those Tampa refugees? What do they do with themselves? Did they like it? Did they grow up? Did they leave? Are they New Zealanders? Are they Afghans? Because those are some questions I get all the time. And now, finally, we have the answers. And I absolutely love writing that passage because in that, you see fully the challenges, the opportunities, the potential, the pitfalls, all the rest of it of growing up as a refugee or an immigrant background kid in New Zealand. So I would absolutely be thrilled if readers of the podcast would go and check it out. And perhaps I think what they'll read from that, what they'll gain from that is that even though I'm from Afghanistan, and I come from a whole nother world, there are so many things where a reader from anywhere in Australia or New Zealand could pick it up and think, oh my God, I totally understand what this guy's saying because my parents have gone through that or I've experienced that myself. Mm-hmm. So that's why I wrote it the way I did.
Look, thank you very much. You've been really a great person to talk to, and your character in the book really, I can tell that what comes through in the book is really true to life, and I think that that's also an impressive feat in your writing. So, look, thanks very much for your company today.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for listening. Cheers.
So, listeners, you can and you should purchase After the Tampa from Melbourne Writers Festival Partner Bookshop Readings. So jump online immediately and make your order. And lastly, just thank you very much for tuning in and for supporting Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.